Greetings. Since this episode is going to be a little bit shorter, I wanted to begin with a quick shout out to subscribers to the Enduring Word YouTube channel. My name is Lance Ralston. It's an honor for me to be a part of Enduring Word. As you may know, I just completed 42 years of pastoral ministry and now have the privilege of being a part of what God is doing here at Enduring Word. Besides this weekly church history series on the Enduring Word channel, I make Bible study and biblical worldview videos for my YouTube channel called Into His Image. Now, we have some exciting changes in store here at Enduring Word that will soon allow us to produce more and better content. All right, so let's get into it. Recapping what we looked at in the last episode, in 1305, the French Archbishop of Bordeaux was elected by the College of Cardinals as Pope Clement V. But Clement never set foot in Rome because the locus of political power had shifted to France and her king, Philip. And this marks the beginning of what's called the Babylonian captivity of the papacy, a 72-year-long period when France dominated the papal office. After Clement, the next six popes, all French, made their headquarters at Avignon in southern France rather than in Rome. Though it began as just a small town when Clement first located there, over the next 70 years it grew to a population of some 80,000, nearly all associated in one way or another with the church bureaucracy. Now, this transfer of the papacy from Rome to France, it had a profound impact on the way all of Europe came to see both the Pope and the leadership of the church. Rome was supposed to be the eternal city, and it was assumed that the Church of Rome, with the Pope as its bishop, went all the way back to the Apostle Peter. That's why people regarded it as special and why it called the shots for everyone else. But if the Pope no longer sat in Rome, if he could now reside in some other locale, what did that say about his authority? Was he indeed Peter's successor? Was he truly the Vicar of Christ? And what did it mean when the Pope seemed to be little more than the political mouthpiece for the King of France? While the French enjoyed having the Pope closer to themselves, the rest of Europe didn't find it much to their liking. The duchies of what would later be called Germany in particular resented it, as they were in constant tension with their French neighbors. A good part of the hostility towards the Avignon papacy revolved around the abuse of church finances. Since the papal states in Italy were no longer contributing, the papacy nearly went bankrupt. To replace lost income, French popes employed a raft of schemes. There were fees for this, taxes for that. Whenever a new bishop was appointed, his first year's income went to the Pope. Veteran bishops were transferred between churches so that the Pope could start that process all over again. Sometimes no bishop would be appointed, so the entire income from an area went to Avignon. And the most lucrative practice was the granting of indulgences. Now, these were passed out for just about any reason, any venture that the church figured was in its interest. From minor public works to war could earn someone an indulgence. And what the indulgences earned grew as time passed. The common people who couldn't afford to purchase such spiritual extravagances and who trusted in a more sincere form of devotion saw all of this as a gross departure from the path of genuine righteousness. Bitter feelings towards Avignon and its papacy grew, especially when the Pope demanded an increase in revenue under the threat of excommunication. You know, hell was supposed to be for unrepentant sinners, not those who couldn't afford to pay the ever more taxes and fees. By 1360, the outcry over the French domination of the church made it clear that the Avignon papacy could not continue. But no one foresaw the tumultuous events a return to Rome would bring. In 1377, the elderly Pope Gregory XI re-entered Rome. But the joy that attended the re-establishment of the papacy there was short-lived. Gregory died within a year. The College of Cardinals, still filled by Frenchmen, yielded to the clamor of a Roman mob and chose an Italian. On Easter Sunday, April 18th, Urban VI was crowned as the new Vicar of Christ. Now, as the next months unfolded, it became clear that Urban was a harsh dictator. The cardinals had second thoughts about his election. In August, they announced that in their earlier decision, a mob had forced the selection of an apostate. They declared the proceedings that had elevated Urban invalid. So, end of round one. A month later, the so-called apostate Pope Urban VI fired off round two by creating a new College of Cardinals. The sitting college, dominated, of course, by French cardinals, chose a new pope from among their number, Clement VII. Clement took a tour of Italy to present himself as the new pope and then headed back to, wait for it, Avignon. So now there were two papal courts, one in France, led by Clement, the other in Italy, presided over by Urban. And that brings us to what's known as the Western or the Great Schism. But that's confusing because the split that took place in the 11th century between the Western Roman Catholic and the Eastern Orthodox churches, it's also called the Great Schism. And frankly, seems of much greater consequence than what we're looking at here. So let's refer to this split in the papacy as the Western Schism, and save the Great Schism for the break that occurred between the East and the West in the 11th century. Okay, so the Western Schism lasted for 39 years. Each papal court had its own college of cardinals, ensuring the succession of its choice. Each pope claimed to be the true vicar of Christ, with the power to excommunicate those who refused to acknowledge him. The other guy was conveniently labeled as Antichrist. Now, of course, the French went with Clement, while Italy and most of the rest of Europe went with Urban. But since England went with Urban, Scotland went with, can you guess it? Yep, Clement. Within each kingdom, there were minorities of support for the other guy. Riots broke out, property was burned, and of all things, a new crusade was called for. In 1395, professors at the University of Paris proposed a general council representing the universal church to meet and heal the schism. Problems immediately arose. Canon law said only the pope could call a general council, and only the pope could ratify any decision the council made. So which pope had those rights? In effect, canon law now prohibited the reunion of Christendom. By 1409, a majority of cardinals from both sides agreed something had to be done. So they met for a general council at Pisa in Italy. They deposed both popes and elected a new pope with the title of Alexander V. And wouldn't you just know it? Neither of the two deposed prelates accepted their action. Now the church had three popes. One of them called for a crusade against another and sold indulgences to pay for it. Well, this ridiculousness finally stirred the people of Europe to action. In 1414, the Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund, he assembled the most impressive church gathering of the era at the German city of Constance. Now, even the Eastern Greek Orthodox Church sent some representatives to this, so you get an idea of just how big this thing was. For the first time, voting took place on a purely national basis. Each nation had one vote. The national structure of the council was highly significant because it shows that the church was reluctantly coming to realize the new alignment of power turning Europe into the modern world. Now, this council took 3 years, but eventually the council got one of the popes to step aside, depose the other two, and chose a new pope, Martin V. One of the deposed popes tried to retain his title, but for all practical purposes, the Council of Constance brought an end to the Western Schism. And just when it seemed that things would get back to normal, Pope Martin made a move which seemed to slit his own throat. The instant that he was seated, he repudiated all acts of the council that had just seated him, except the one by which he ruled. Yet it was the council's acts that had built the authority by which they could name him pope. It was as if he said his election was based on a fiction. Now, looking back, Pope Martin's actions seemed foolish, but he had good reason to deny the work of the council because it raised an important question. Who's greater, a council that seats a pope or the pope whose authority convenes councils? This blatant foray into political machinations dug a trough for the papacy that it would take quite a while to get out of. Now, as we end this episode, that's focused, of course, on the major dysfunctions in the church, I think it seems a good place for an editorial comment. Over the years that I've done this series on church history, I've only had a few Roman Catholics who've gone after me for not being fair with the Roman Church and the papacy. A lot more of them have remarked on how fair they found the material. So let me say this, the church, whether we're talking about the Eastern Orthodox, the Church in the East, the Roman Catholic Church, or the dozens of Protestant groups, listen, we have a mixed record when it comes to faithfulness to God. There are high points and low, golden ages, gilded ages, and ages of decadence and ruin. There's no point in whitewashing those times in church history when the people of God didn't act like it. This era of the Western Schism is at best an embarrassment, No amount of spin can make it anything else. Pope Alexander VI's real name was Roderigo Borgia. He ruled from 1492 to 1503 and was grossly immoral, obsessed with providing wealth and power for his children. Yeah, I said children. So much for that celibacy thing. The entire 15th century was an abysmal period for the popes, as they were far more interested in politics and the arts than the things of God. As Bruce Shelley puts it, quote, "The pope often could not make up his mind whether he was the successor of Peter or Caesar. Political corruption and immorality in the Vatican reached unbelievable heights under the Borgias," unquote. And while things were horribly out of whack in the upper reaches of church hierarchy, there were at the same time many godly bishops, priests, and deacons who served their parishes well, with a heart to glorify God. It's just that the papacy was certainly no example to follow. So Pope Martin tried to upend the Council of Constance, but what happened there was not to be forgotten by the representatives. Estrangement from the Vatican was growing. Men began to think in terms of national churches and a church governed by representative bodies instead of a tyrannical dictator. The ground for the Reformation was being plowed.